Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 190, featuring Zap Anderson of Autodesk. Zap is a very interesting guy, very charismatic guy, really fun, and he and I have been chatting on Facebook for a long time. He is actually a big fan of the podcast, and he's wanted to be on the podcast, so I was more than happy to oblige him. We were trying to see if we could do this during Total Chaos, because he was at Total Chaos in Bulgaria earlier this year, but unfortunately with our schedules, it was a little tough. So we were lucky because he ended up being at SIGGRAPH in Vancouver as well. So he and I met up in Vancouver. We were trying to find a good place to record it, and unfortunately the only thing we could find was a nice quiet place in the halls of the convention center, and we just basically just sat on the floor and chatted for an hour or so, and we're able to do a really cool podcast. Zap is very, very influential in the world of shaders, both for his time over at Mental Images and as well as his time at Autodesk. And we talk a lot about that and his very interesting history that only Zap has a way to tell his history, which is, again, his part of his character and his charm. But we also talked a lot towards the end of the podcast about a subject that I am very interested in, that I find a little bit controversial, but maybe you guys will see what I think. And it's basically about PBR, or physically based rendering. And the term that really bothers me is the term metalness. And there's more of a semantic issue there, but I think it's something that bothers me. And so he and I talked about it for a long time, and really just sort of thinking about how reflectivity works in objects, and more specifically how they're based in physics and in the real world. And it ended up being really, really interesting one. I ended up using a lot of the information I had with Zap to write a blog post that will be hopefully coming out this week and will coincide with this podcast. But I'm going to be writing a mentalness blog post, so go to chaosgroup.com and check out our blog section and tell us what you think there. I think it'll be pretty cool to do that. And I really want to thank Zap for giving me his time and allowing us to be to talk about these things. So really, really cool guy. A couple of announcements. Let's see. V-Ray Next for Maya Beta 3 is out. A lot of interesting stuff is going on there. So you guys know, if you are a V-Ray user, you can download the beta for free and try it out and let us know what you think. Super cool stuff going on there. A lot of interesting things with our new Toon Shader, which is really kind of interesting, as well as some huge improvements we've done in the IPR world and GPU stuff. So good stuff to check out there. And generally, there's lots of really cool things. So please check it out and give us your feedback. That's the important part of being part of a beta. Speaking of beta, as you guys already know, V-Ray Cloud is in beta as well. So if you are interested in getting some free credits to render on the cloud and try things out, we would love to get your feedback in that as well. So just go to chaosgroup.com and sign up for the V-Ray Cloud beta. In terms of events, next week, SketchUp Basecamp is happening in Palm Springs, and that will be very interesting. Lots of Chaos Group people will be there, and so they definitely go and say hi. I will not be there because I will be going to Malta for Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn 2018, better known as THU. It's one of my favorite events, as many of you guys know. I love going to this event. I tend to record a ton of really interesting podcasts there. I am being very ambitious this year, and I'm going to try to see if I can get about 10 or more podcasts. And I don't know if I can do it, but I will see what I can muster. But it will be really cool to have that and to talk to a lot of the really interesting people that are there. Amongst the podcasts, I will also be hosting three panels, which Andre tells me I can probably turn into podcasts. But if you are at THU, I would love to see you guys come and attend some of these talks. They're happening at night, I think something like 11:30 at night or midnight, because, you know, it's THU, because we're crazy that way. But the three panels that will be happening are all related to the balance between technology and creativity, which is something that I'm very passionate about. And I think THU is a perfect place to discuss those things. So the first panel will be called Who Painted the Picture, the Artist or the Paintbrush? And the idea here is to sort of think about people who make tools and artists that use them and how they influence each other in different ways, or sometimes may even, contradict each other or make things more challenging. So it'd be really interesting to have that. So there'll be some technology people there as well as some really great artists that use tools, and sort of their feedback on that balance as well would be really good to have a discussion on that. The second one is the 1,000-year quest to perfectly recreate human in art. And that is going to be really interesting because I have some very good technology people in art as well as some really great artists. As you guys know, I have a huge passion for digital humans, but the quest to represent humans goes long before computers were even invented or even cameras were invented in painting and all kinds of stuff. So we've got some really great artists to discuss some of those points and sort of understand the challenges of representing digital humans and how technology has been part of that challenge, as well as try to create some solutions for that challenge. So really interesting to have that conversation. The last one will be, will artificial intelligence replace you? And that has become a very interesting subject. Deep learning, machine learning, and all of that new technology has started to creep into the world of creativity and the artist world. And the idea is to really explore how machine learning is going to sort of either replace artists in some ways. I think people are paranoid about it, but really I think what it can do is enhance the artist's existence and really sort of give them a new skill set that they can use. So could be a very interesting conversation. And again, we'll have some very cool people in that area, both experts in the field of machine learning, as well as people that figure out how to use it and what to do with it and on the creative side. All right, guys, thank you so much. Hopefully you will enjoy this great podcast with Zap Anderson from Autodesk.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So we're sitting here on the floor of the convention center. This is a good way to go.
Yeah, it's sketchy, but unless a marching band comes by, it might actually work.
I think it's going to be fine. I think this is going to be just fine. We just got to make sure that we don't turn too far ahead, because then if just look at each other. It's going to be fine. So how you doing now?
Still alive.
Still alive. How many cigarettes is this for you?
My first was 2005, but I skipped a few. So it's like in the 10 range-ish,
right?
Roughly. I actually don't know in detail.
My first was in 95.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the 20s.
Okay. That's doable.
So this is old school to me.
Yeah.
It's my second time in Vancouver. Like the city.
Yes, same here, yes.
You were here like, what was it, 4 years ago? I think it was 4 years ago.
Yeah. Must be.
Okay.
Yes, I was here.
Yeah.
So I was looking out at all those seaplanes and stuff. Like,
mesmerized by that.
Yeah, I want to do those. And this time I did. So that was
You did?
Cool. Yes.
So what was it like?
It was pretty cool, actually. And the funny part was the pilot.
We should explain that just so people know. So there's a big convention center.
Yep.
And it's looking out onto the bay.
Yep.
And right at the convention center, there's big glass windows. And you look out and there's a bunch of seaplanes that are parked out there. That are
taking off all day.
Taking off and landing all day. And you just watch these and you're just... it's mesmerizing.
Yes, and you want to fly because I'm a flying nerd.
Yeah.
So this time I bought some tickets, and The pilot said there's a seat up by me. I'm like, me, I'm going to sit by the pilot.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, he flies off. And there's you have these headphones with like a guided tour kind of thing going.
Right.
And the weather was a little sketchy that day. But the funniest part for me was when this comes apart in the tour when they talk about really early seaplane flying here in Vancouver. It's almost like they invented it or something. I don't know. And like how bad those pilots were, how crappy they flew into you know, bad weather and kept crashing and stuff. Exactly the kind of things you want to hear.
You want to hear
in
about
an audio tour on board a an airplane. Just then it starts raining. So and like visibility goes like to zero when we're flying between the mountains over there. So it almost like Spielberg or someone would have directed it. So that was pretty cool. That was a nice little tour.
Yeah, so how long was the flight?
That was a 20-minute one. This is a 45-minute one. I guess they fly longer, but this was the 20-minute one. So.
Okay.
Yeah, it was nice.
And you just buy a seat and
you
go on a tour?
Yeah, you buy a seat. You can buy it online.
How much is the ticket?
The short one was 130 Canadian.
Okay.
Bucks. The long one is 200 Canadian bucks.
I heard is actually someone was telling me that you can actually take a seaplane over to Vancouver Island.
Yeah. They have, actual line, you know, regular flights out of here.
Right.
So you can go places. So like you can buy a ticket to a place.
Right. Apparently you can go to Vancouver Island very fast and cheap from here.
Apparently, yes.
And that's like the secrets, which I'm now putting up on the podcast.
Mm. Top secret. This is so CG.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool. I mean, I appreciate that you've been wanting to actually be on the podcast. You've had a lot of stories.
I have a story or two. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
it's fun.
And I've been listening for a long time, and I'm a kind of a fan. So
cool.
I should do the "We're Not Worthy" kind of thing, but then I mess up your microphone wires, so I won't do that. No, I enjoy them because they're freeform, weird, and wonderful, and you get all sorts of funny stories out of people, especially those times you bring a bottle. I don't see any bottle here, so the
we will drink tonight, Sam.
I know.
We will drink tonight.
I know. It's a little early for that, I guess. Yeah.
But it's fun.
Yeah, I don't know what stories you want.
Well,
know.
First of all, we should tell people that you did your own version or your remix of the CG Garage.
Yes, I did.
Song.
It might have been playing just before this.
Right.
I thought that would be funny too, because I used to be producing, you know, electronic music for a long time.
Right.
I even pressed and made my own CD back in 1997, where CDs were still a thing. 500 copies. There's still like 5 of them in my house.
Oh, so you mean like from Glassmaster?
Yes.
Actually, not from printing.
No. Actually mastered with actual print. I learned so much about printing and, you know, CMYK and stuff when doing that. It was a very educational experience in so many ways. Yeah, so yes, I made this fancy little remix. It's not the best thing I've ever done, but it's was a quickie. It was fun. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate it. How did you do the vocals?
So the vocals is actually the original vocals.
Really?
Yes, run through a vocoder plugin. This is, I should tell you, I have a bunch of actual equipment for music that I did not use any of it for this.
Uh-huh.
This is literally like Ableton Live running on my computer, and everything is plugins and digitals and digital stuff.
Okay.
Like, because you can do so insanely much now, and you have so many people. I mean, even I used to be super in love with old analog synthesizers, and I still have a few.
Okay,
and they haven't been on for 10 years. I have a Korg Monopoly, I have a Juno 60, and I have an old Yamaha CS5.
Oh, you don't have a Moog?
I do not have a Moog, no.
Right.
I do have a Casio ZZ-101, though.
Nice.
So I have, yeah. But none of it has been on since 2008. There was a big thunderstorm that killed my main music computer that kind of tied everything together. And I was like, don't have the energy.
Okay.
That's a little dull, but now you can do so much, and especially with the new plugin stuff, you have so many ways to dirty up the sound. It used to be like simulations of analog stuff sounded fake, but you can throw on so many layers of dirt and gnarliness and offsets and nonlinear amplification and God knows what.
Yep.
So it actually sounds pretty damn good. So
I like that.
Yeah.
Well, I love the fact that we can do all this stuff with music now,
and
it's pretty interesting. I've learned a lot about audio just from recording two voices, you know, and that was something I didn't know that I would learn, but that's something that's it's a different thing. I also learned that trying to denoise you know, 2 hours of audio can actually take a long time.
It can. They should make an AI, they should make an AI for that.
They should make an AI.
They should definitely make an AI for that.
Yeah, yeah,
I heard a good thing about AI denoising.
AI denoising is pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it has to work for audio too somehow.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about your history. I know you work for Autodesk now.
I do.
How long have you worked for Autodesk?
I actually been employed by Autodesk 3 times in my life, which is an interesting story.
So have you been fired twice or did you quit twice? Or is it one and one?
I've been fired, I've been downsized twice.
Okay.
And it was very interesting history behind that. But if we go even further back and really want to start in the beginning of this giant mess and me and computer graphics, it was... You know, the first computer I ever used was a Swedish computer, an ABC-80. And I guarantee you have never heard of this.
This is a Swedish computer.
It's a Swedish computer. There was a Swedish television manufacturer in the late 70s that thought, I've heard of this thing called computers, and we should probably try to sell one and make one.
Okay.
So this television manufacturer called Luxor, like the place in Egypt, they built this computer, ABC-80. Actually, they kind of bought the design from some company, but they literally manufactured it. The monitor was actually an old black and white TV that it just took the TV stuff out. You could buy the exact same TV with the TV parts in it from the same company if you wanted. And the entire computer was like in the keyboard part. And the
kind of like a Commodore 64.
Like a Commodore 64, exactly. But this was way before the Commodore 64.
Right.
This machine, by default, had 16 kilobytes of memory.
Right.
Not megabytes.
Kilobytes.
16,348 bytes of memory.
Right.
If you have the advanced version, it had 32 kilobytes.
Wow.
Which I
That's
used.
A lot.
Yeah. It ran a
My first computer was a Sinclair ZX81.
Yeah.
It had 1K.
Yes, I know.
One kilobyte.
And it shared that with the video memory. A friend of mine had that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The cool one with this was that it had a Z80 processor just like the ZX81 had. And but it ran at 3 megahertz, which was like super fast. Mega, not gigahertz.
Right.
3 megahertz.
3 megahertz.
And another cool thing with it was you programmed it in BASIC, but the story behind it was apparently this company that did the design of the computer. I was doing the design of the computer for some other company, which then decided not to use the computer. And then comes these television manufacturers, they design us a computer, and they already have the design. So they're like, oh yeah, we'll totally do it. We'll charge you too for designing the computer. But they already had the computer. So they were like, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to make the BASIC interpreter better. So it actually has like a semi-compiling BASIC interpreter, which is like radical for 1979 kind of stuff.
Okay, yeah.
So like if you took a Commodore 64 and did a loop, you know, from 1 to 10,000, that took about 30 seconds. On the ABC-80, a loop from 1 to 10,000 took about 10 seconds. But if you used integer variables, it took 1 second.
Okay.
And that was like... And it didn't matter on the Commodore if you used integers or not. It was still 30 seconds. It was like, you know, 30 times faster than Commodore 64 just in BASIC.
Right.
And the cool thing for me, though, with this computer, we're going really historical.
Sure.
If you lifted the lid off and you lifted the actual keyboard so you see the entire motherboard, everything, there was no, like, custom chips in this. Everything was off-the-shelf components. So the entire left half of the motherboard was the actual computer. There was the CPU over here. There was the RAM, and then there was some EEPROMs with the actual, you know, BASIC interpreter thing in it.
Okay.
The entire right half of the board was the graphics, including like the character generator that printed the characters on screen. There was actually a PROM chip on the board which contained the definition of which pixels were a character.
Wow.
And the most, and everything like this, not a single custom chip. And the coolest part was it was labeled on the motherboard. It says, here's the dot clock, here's horizontal sync, here's vertical sync. So what I did, I took a little breadboard, and then I added some counter circuits. And one counter circuit I incremented from the dot clock, which was the same as the processor clock, actually. Mm-hmm. And then I reset it with horizontal sync. So now I have a number that, as the electron beam is sweeping from left to right, is counting up. Mm-hmm. The other counter I set to be counted by horizontal sync and reset by vertical sync. So now I have a count counter that counts
or the swaps
as the electron beam goes from top to bottom.
Right.
Address and memory with this. Okay. Put in a 32 kilobyte static memory. I bought static memory because I didn't want to care about refresh, because you know that would have added extra circuitry, I thought. And static memory at the time was even 32 kilobyte was expensive. Later I realized, wait a minute, reading this thing 60 frames a second actually perfect refresh. I could have used dynamic RAM, but whatever. It was a static RAM chip. These two counters were plugged into the address bus of this, and I read out on the data bus the bits, and for reasons this turns out you can get 4 bits.
Okay.
And that I put in a little homemade DA converter out of resistors, so I could get 16 shades of gray out of this.
Okay.
And so I should tell you first that this computer had graphics originally. It had graphics of this type called teletext, where each character cell was actually divided into 2 by 3 pixels. That means the resolution of this fantastic computer was 78 by 75 pixels in white or black. You had the choice.
Right.
You can imagine the super high res stuff, like how you do Transformers 9 in 78 by 75 pixels. It doesn't really work, right?
With 1 bit color.
With 1 bit color, exactly. So when I was done with my stuff, I had the insane resolution of 240 by 240 pixels in 16 glorious shades of gray.
That's a lot. That's a huge jump.
That's a huge jump from 78 by 75 to 240 by 240. I know everyone listening is giggling at us here,
right,
but that was true. And
but you made your own graphics card.
Yes, I made my own graphics card. The tricky bit of this graphic card, making the bits come out on screen was actually simple because that's all I described.
Mm-hmm.
Getting the bits into the memory, that was the tricky part. So you needed to have actual switches for the address, so you temporarily switch the address to where you want to write,
right,
and you need to put the data on the data bus and wiggle some write thingy and all this kind of stuff. That was the hard part. Like half of my graphic cards was the circuitry that did the writing.
Right.
The one that actually did the reading and just painted the pixels, that was trivial.
Right.
And for one of the extra stupid things I did with this, like this number that was counting from left to right and top to bottom, when that was reset, it wasn't actually reset to zero. It was reset to a value I could choose.
Okay.
That meant I can actually move the graphic around. So one of the first stupid things I did, I wrote a piece of code that draw a ball, like a diffuse shaded little ball.
Sure.
Since I could move the graphics around, I can make this instantly bounce around the screen, even though the graphics was actually not fast enough for that, because I was just moving the start of video memory.
Right.
And then I used the old graphics, which was still there. My graphics was just showing up like on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I made a couple of flippers, and I made a flipper game.
Okay.
So which was bouncing around this super high-res ball with these super low-res Yankee flippers.
Right.
And I had an awesome flipper game that exactly one computer in the entire universe could play, mine.
Right.
So I didn't sell many of that game for some reason.
You sold it to yourself.
I sold it to myself, yes, yes. And then, of course, I wrote a ray tracer.
You wrote a ray tracer at
in
that
BASIC,
time.
Yes, in BASIC.
Okay.
In a dialect of BASIC that doesn't do recursion.
Okay. So how did that work?
Well, you have to make your own stack and a bunch of stuff. It can be done, but it just becomes trickier.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just say it wasn't fast.
Okay.
Let's just say, you know, the mirrored sphere on the checkerboard was still like a 2-day render, even at, you know, 100 by 100 pixels.
Right.
I don't actually remember how insanely slow it was, but it was insanely slow.
Okay.
So that's like my first graphics card and my first render. And I did even more stupid stuff. Some guys in an office, and they were throwing away an old fax machine. It was like a seriously old fax machine that which used a rotating drum.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was like, you have a rotate? Can I have that? And I was like, yeah, we were literally going to throw it on the trash. And I got some AD converters. I made the scanner so I could scan pictures into my fantastic graphics card.
Right.
And then I made the earliest possible version of Photoshop myself, sort of, in BASIC, obviously, then.
Of course.
But, yeah, I don't think John Knoll had to be scared about my version of Photoshop in BASIC. Anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, that's...
So what year was this?
This must have been, like, 80... See, now, because I built the graphics card actually as my senior thesis. I'm actually educated in electronics.
Okay.
So I normally jokingly say nothing I do professional of any training for whatsoever, which is true. Sort of. Well, we learned a little programming in school, but mostly it was electronics.
Right.
So it was my special project. So I did it in 86. Must have been 1986 was when I graduated in 87, but this work was done in 86. So, I mean, by that time, this computer was outdated, right?
Sure.
So, because now PCs existed and stuff.
Right.
But it was like this, the trick was make this stupid old thing do CG, basically. And I did.
Right.
And yeah, so that's the first crazy, maddeningly crazy stuff I done. Of course, I also made my own music software for this computer.
That ties back to what we were talking
about,
right?
Yeah, exactly. So I made my own sampler using the same thing that I was able to scan the photos with, and own software that could play the samples. Now, remember, we only have 32 kilobytes of memory, which will be your samples and your code. So there was not very much samples. You can do like the drum machine, but and yeah.
That's little. Why it sounds like that.
Yeah.
That's why the music sounds the way it does.
It does, yeah. Because, yeah. But that is really, that we're really back in the days of time. Then my actual quote-unquote career in this started. I got hired by a company called EMT in Sweden, which was actually an AutoCAD distributor. So they were selling and distributing AutoCAD.
Yeah.
And this was just around the time that AutoCAD became kinda 3D. Actually, first AutoCAD was 2.5D.
Was it like AutoCAD 10?
It was AutoCAD 9, I think. I think the first Super Yankee came in AutoCAD 1.2, because they changed the numbering. So it went from 1.4 or something to 9.
So like 9 or something,
yeah. Yeah, so I think it was 9 had a 3D face.
Okay.
And the other one had all, because you have this very weird concept in AutoCAD of everything having an elevation and a thickness.
Right.
And then you have something called user coordinate system. So you could put stuff at an elevation and a thickness, which basically if you made a circle and put a thickness on it, you had a cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can have user coordinate system, so then you could basically rotate these cylinders around to other places. And it was super strange. And I wrote the ray tracer for PC for that called Ray Tracker.
Really?
Yes. And I even in the end had animation tools written in Autolisp, so you could inside AutoCAD animate stuff.
Okay.
I have stuff on my website. I have the bicycle from Red's Dream, the Pixar, and the Luxo Junior as bouncing a ball back and forth to each other. It's all done in Ray Tracker back in the day.
Wow.
And this was actually just a toy thing I was doing on the side. But my boss at the company I was working on, the one that was distributing AutoCAD, so this was kind of cool. We should probably try to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't put like any marketing effort or something. We put it like in the price list was like Ray Tracker, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And we sold two copies.
Two copies?
Two copies.
Wow.
I still know both people that bought them back in the day. One guy was designing like trade show booths, and the other was a local school, which was like an art school where they learned like traditional, like they were using airbrushing and stuff.
Okay.
But they wanted to look at this computer, what was it called, graphics. They heard about it, so they bought a copy and played with it. And then somebody called Autodesk released software called 3D Studio.
Mm-hmm. No, they didn't.
No, they didn't actually. Discrete Kinetics? How was it?
Yoast Group first.
Yeah, Gary Yoast, yes.
So it was the Yoast Group first, and then I believe that Discrete bought them.
Exactly. So anyway, so Gary and Tom Hudson, both people I know, and Tom I work with to this day. If you don't even know, Tom Hudson is back on the Max team working with me.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, absolutely. He's done a bunch of cool stuff in Max. Anyway, they made this thing called 3D Studio, which was way faster and more swankier than my software. So yeah, my software sold two copies ever.
Right.
And then freaking Tom Hudson come. I'm gonna.
Well, you tried to turn Autodesk into like a 3D application.
AutoCAD. Yes. AutoCAD. I tried to turn it into AutoCAD rendering animation application. I might have been a tiny bit ahead of my time there, and because it was slow as all heck and stuff.
Right.
But it kind of worked. And
sure.
Yeah. It was fun times. But I never worked professionally with this was all a side thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what this company also was doing, they were making like a plugin to AutoCAD called MechSlide. It was mechanical construction software. Mm-hmm. And that was really what we were doing. And that was my day job, was mechanical construction. And in the middle of the night, I wrote stupid renderers and stuff like that.
Yep.
And that was kind of what was happening. And the next thing that happened was that I was at a developers conference that Autodesk had, and I met our worst competitor at the time, a company called GeniusCAD Software. And I got so much better along with those people than those I was actually working for.
Okay.
So making a long story short, I basically jumped ship over and started working at GeniusCAD Software.
Okay.
And eventually they made a product called Genius Mechanical. It was also mechanical design.
Okay.
And the irony was that I was writing surface texturing symbols for that. But I mean, the surface, it looks like a little square root symbol with a bunch of numbers and stuff that tells you the roughness and all these kind of things.
Right.
So the irony, I was making surface texturing back then, but it has nothing to do with computer graphics. It was actual surface texturing.
Right.
Anyway, suddenly the GeniusCAD software gets acquired by Autodesk.
Okay.
And the product becomes Autodesk Mechanical. And for the first time, now I'm employed by Autodesk.
Okay.
And that's, this is about...
By accident.
By accident, yes.
Okay.
I've only been hired by Autodesk once. No, twice. Oh, we get to that.
Right.
So I was acquired and became an Autodesk guy and worked as an Autodesk guy for a bunch of... So this was, I think this was 1990. I don't remember the years now.
But you're under the Max Group at this point, or 3D Studio Group.
Now, yes, but still, we're talking, I'm working about the mechanical software still.
Mechanical.
I was just still hired working on this mechanical stuff, right?
Okay.
So there's no, Max doesn't even, well, this because it was mid-90s. I don't remember the years exactly.
Okay.
I think 98 was the acquisition date, if I don't misremember.
Right.
So 98 I became Autodesk guy.
Okay.
Anyway, but mechanical. We're still in the mechanical world. And all the rendering stuff is just, you know, side tinkering, what playing with. I was playing with Max. I was doing stuff, you know, because we could, since Autodesk employee, you could basically get it and use it. So, but that was all a hobby. And I was doing mechanical stuff. And then... what happened, I might be we ignore the years, but sometimes late 90s, Autodesk decides to shut down this German company that they had acquired. Just overnight, like, no, we're not doing this. So everyone was fired, including me, because I was like kind of connected to this German company. I was still working from home. I always worked from home in my garage since forever, basically. Anyway, so... I end up being, working temporarily for another company because I was basically laid off. But the problem Autodesk had, they were still selling this AutoCAD mechanical thing, but they just laid off everybody who wrote it.
Right.
And since this was a German company, they had some labor law. You can't even hire one guy back because they reopened the office or something, whatever. But there's one guy in Sweden... which is not under German labor law, and even that office is still his garage, so let's hire him back. So after just a month or so, they like realized, oh crap, we need someone who knows any of this code.
Okay.
So I was like rehired for back to Autodesk, and I got to deal with everybody's old code for a few years.
Sure.
Like code where they were literally like leaving the cursor blinking in the middle of the line when they were laid off, you know.
Oh, wow.
That I have no clue what it was doing.
Like, you have to finish their thoughts.
Yes, exactly. And most of it documented in German.
Oh,
now, I do read some German. I know a little German, as they say. If you've seen Top Secret,
the
joke.
He's sitting right over there.
He's sitting right over there, exactly. But it was kind of a miserable time, honestly. It was like a few years that was kind of crap, working on code that was uninteresting, and I have no idea how it was supposed to work. There was nobody to ask.
Yep.
And yeah. And then we're at around 2002-ish,
uh-huh.
and as you know, there was this little .com thing,
uh-huh.
and stuff went up, and then it went kind of down.
Yep.
So at the time, Autodesk again laid off a bunch of people, I think 10% of the entire workforce. I managed to tag along, but then it was still going down, so they laid off 10% again.
Okay.
And in this second round of 10%, I got included, so I got then laid off from Autodesk.
Right.
And then I was unemployed for a little while until I stumbled over this somewhere that there was this company called Mental Images that was
another
looking.
Another German company.
Another German company. Hey, I'm working for Germans. It worked before, sort of.
Right, right.
They got acquired by Autodesk, but whatever. So I sent the mail to them, and like, yeah, oh, I like rendering. It would be fun to work with it, whatever. And I had been tinkering with the subsurface scattering shader for 3D Studio Max also.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really bizarre way. I don't even remember how it worked now in detail, but somehow I could make little red come through the airs, basically. Mm-hmm. And I sent an email to their secretary there at Mental Images, Lisa is her name or was,
mm-hmm.
and I had problems with my email. This is one of those things in the world. So I sent the email again and double check, did you really get this email?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's one of these things that takes your letter to the top of the pile or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended up on the boss's desk, Rolf Herken, who was the CEO of Mental.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got to read it. So there's a guy in Sweden that writes shaders. Okay. I don't really care. I can call him, whatever.
Yeah, okay.
So I get a phone call from Lisa saying our CEO wants to talk to you.
Okay.
And then Rolf calls me and there's a little interview and it's going kind of okay, but not really super great.
Okay.
Until I managed to mention the word subsurface scattering and this silence in the other end. It's like, you think you can write the subsurface scattering shader for Mental Ray? And I'm like, yeah, I guess. I never touched Mental Ray in my life.
Right.
But I
rendering's
probably...
Rendering's
rendering. Rendering's rendering. I've done it, so I know the principle. And it's like,
yeah.
Okay,
I'm going to... Can I do it in BASIC?
Exactly. No. So they sent me Mental Ray and all the books and all the stuff.
Yeah.
And they were like, can you do it? And I was like, yeah, I'm going to try. So I made a version mm-hmm. that kind of worked. It was very strangely done. It used output shaders in Mental Ray to do the blurring of the light in post. And it was 2D based and super fake, almost like you would do it on a GPU now was kind of the way I was doing it.
Yeah.
So because it was kind of inspired of the work that, because this was after the Matrix Reloaded. So they had done the work, the Escape Studios had done the work with the 2D fakey subsurface. They basically baked the light into the texture and blurred it. And I was doing kind of the same, but in screen space, which was actually easier.
Right.
So I have that. And so the Mental Image guys say, okay, come down to Berlin. We're going to talk to you. And they flew me down to Berlin. And I sit in the office, and I got interviewed by everybody. And they're like, yeah, we like this, but we don't like the thing that you made in output shader. You need to use something in Mental Ray called light mapping to actually get the light first and get the subsurface scattering happening in the actual render pass. In my case, I was not rendering and doing the subsurface scattering as a fake in post.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, yeah, I see how that can be done. I get it. Yeah, that's okay. I hadn't read the line about light mapping in the manual.
Mm-hmm.
So they were like, okay, can you do it? I'm like, yeah, sure. Okay, can I have it done by Tuesday? I'm like,
what?
Okay, actually it doesn't sound too bad, so I probably could have it done by Tuesday. Okay, you sure? I'm like, I think so. Okay, you're hired. I'm like, okay, this was weird.
Okay.
But I did it. I made the subsurface scattering and it was done by Tuesday. And everyone was really happy.
Mm-hmm.
I acquired the title I had for many years. I was officially given a bunch of business cards. Nobody told me this, but I got business card. And I read the business card. My title is Shader Wizard. Not my idea, but Shader Wizard was my official title.
Okay.
Now, in retrospect, the story behind this whole thing seems to be that Mental Images had promised Autodesk to have subsurface scattering in Mental Ray to some given date, probably that Tuesday, right? And they had a subsurface scattering shader, but it sucked.
Right.
It was unusable.
Okay.
And they were panicking. And then they find this Swedish guy who happened to mention subsurface scattering.
This
could solve our problem. Yes, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went on to solve a whole bunch of other problems. So I don't think they, was unhappy hiring me. I mean, I wrote the arch and design material for Mental Ray. I wrote all the production shader library and all this kind of stuff, So a whole bunch of Mental Ray shaders. And so the hiring at Mental Image was 2004. So that's really when I started in this industry for real. Anything before 2004 was me, playing around on my own time.
Sure.
But now I was in the computer graphics system industry. I was like, yay. Okay. Fun work.
Well, cool. All right. So I want to talk to you a little bit about something else because I know there's going to be more of your history. I'm sure that happened since then, obviously, but that's the kind of the beginning.
Yeah.
But when we were, you were at Total Chaos, right?
Yes.
And you and I were talking about stuff. And then I got into this thing because I have written, and I haven't released it yet, but I have written a blog post specifically about a word that I hate because it is not scientific at all, and it's being used in the term to make people think that they're doing very scientifically correct lighting. And so the type of rendering or shading that we're talking about is PBR, which stands for
physically based rendering.
So you'd assume that everything would be based on real physics,
sort of. Yes,
right. But in physically based rendering, they use a term called,
you want me to say
metalness?
No, yes.
I have never opened a physics book and asked
fine metalness. Exactly.
And so you started the catalyst for how I should write my blog post, which is what I've been writing since then.
Okay, cool.
I actually wrote it a while ago. I haven't just published it because it's crazy shit's going on. But metalness is not...
It's not
a variable.
It's not a physical property, really. So what's happening here is, I think the one of the origins of this is really Substance Painter, which is kind of where it comes from. So basically what you do have in practice, you have two different models. You're either making a metal or you're making a non-metal, like a dielectric, basically.
So a dielectric is, in physics terms.
Yes.
In physics terms, you have dielectric materials, which means it's a material that does not conduct electricity.
Correct.
And then you have conductive materials that do conduct electricity.
Also known as metals.
Famously
known as metals.
Famously.
Yes.
But water is also conductive.
True. But it's a dielectric. That's a different story.
But there's dielectrics and conductives. So you have metals and non-metals.
Yes.
Then, which are two states.
Yes.
There's nothing that's half metal, half non-metal.
This is correct.
In the real world.
Right.
Right?
And the intent when you use this is really to use the metalness more as a mask than anything else.
As a mask, right?
Yes.
So the reason you need in-betweens is to deal with aliasing.
Basically, yes. And
right?
Only that, right.
So it's a mask of metal versus non-metal material.
So, I mean, there's an example, I think, that comes with, like, Substance Painter. It's like some battle axe, you know, which is just an object, and it has just one material on it, and everything is in the texturing. So you have the wood for the handle, and you have the metal for the actual blade of the axe.
Right.
And it's just metalness is one on the blade, and it's zero on the handle.
Right.
And maybe in some anti-aliased pixel there in the middle, there might be 0.5, who knows.
Right.
But that's how it's supposed to be used.
But people don't necessarily understand that.
This might be true, yes.
This might
someone
be true.
Someone puts 35% metalness on something and expects it to be physics, and it kind of isn't.
It's not.
It's absolutely not, yeah.
Because you know one of my other famous things that I like to quote, that everything has Fresnel.
Yes.
And people using metalness as a Fresnel substitute.
Yeah.
That's wrong.
Yes. Now, technically, dielectrics has Fresnel. Well,
Yes,
conductors have a different kind of Fresnel.
They do.
But they do. But everything has Fresnel.
Right.
So we sing it together. Everything has Fresnel.
Yeah.
Anyway, where was I? Yeah, so this is completely true. So everything has Fresnel. And this is one of the things, you know, when I made, back in the day when I made the Arch and Design material, I gave the user two options for the Fresnel. Either you use the Fresnel based on actual IOR value, which sadly was not the default. And the other mode was where you can like draw your little curve. You had like a facing amount of reflectivity for facing, one at the edge and a little curve thingy.
Right.
And sadly, I gave that as the default, which is something I regret to this day. Mm-hmm. And I also gave some dumb default values, like the facing was 0.2, whereas for most things, it's like 0.04 or whatever it's for glass. You know, you can compute it from the IOR because that's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
So none of that should ever have been there. But sadly, it was, and it became kind of a standard, and people had, there was many years there was shader that all behaved that kind of, I don't know who started it, you know, but you find even shaders, they call it F0, it's the reflectivity facing you, and just trying to set that as an input, doesn't actually make physical sense. It makes intuitive sense to a person.
Right.
But the problem is shading isn't intuitive.
Right.
Because there, here's the thing. Here's why so many times when I tried to start introducing physically based rendering, there was always these old school people that say, oh, I tweak everything till it looks right.
Sure.
And here's the problem. You can't.
No.
Because the human, you know, psycho-optical subsystem is inherently incapable of perceiving absolute luminance of something.
Right.
We cannot see how bright something is. We only see the differences in luminance.
Yes.
And we only see deltas. And it's even worse, we only see the second derivative because we're walking edge detectors.
Right.
So there's this, you might not know, but I made a class for Mike Seymour at FX PhD. What's it called? Production Rendering Techniques with Mental Ray or something.
Okay.
It was like in 2000, so it's 10 years ago.
Okay.
I made this 10 years ago. But this course...
I was going to give everyone the link, but I don't think it's relevant anymore.
Well, that's the thing. It is. Because
it is. Okay, it is as a subject, but not as a renderer.
Exactly.
Okay.
Because what I spent a lot of time in this course is explaining physics, explaining how light works,
explaining how
light units work and why you have so many of them, which you care about, which is only two.
Right.
And I explain, you know, how diffuse and glossy surfaces and all that stuff works.
Sure.
And all like area lights, that if you have the same incoming amount of light, you make the area light smaller, well, the surface of the light has to become brighter to still emit the same total amount of diffuse light.
All this
stuff I go through in this course. And one part specifically is what we see and we do not see. So I actually give links to a talk, a TED talk about a guy that talks about basically optical illusions. Because these optical illusions show how shitty we are at seeing things. And I have a few optical illusions in the slides for this, where I show something that looks like some complicated gradient of the dark things at the bottom and bright thing at the top. Mm-hmm. But it actually is, everything is just a little rhomboid, which has within itself there's a gradient, and the whole screen is full of those. Mm-hmm. Your brain reinterpret this as a giant gradient, but there is no giant gradient. Everything, the top of the screen and the bottom of the screen, everything
same
is identical.
Yeah.
Everything the same. And of course you see in the classic example with the checkerboard, when one is in shadow and the other is not.
Yeah.
And it's impossible for you to say that this and this is the same brightness.
Right.
These pixels are the same, because you can clearly see that one is brighter than the other.
Right.
There's another interesting example that is the same. There is, I saw in some book, imagine you have literally just a cartoon, a drawing, a pencil drawing of a carpet. And that carpet has little gray squares on it. Mm-hmm. But there's also sections where there's darker gray and the square in the middle is even darker.
Yeah.
So it's like you have a bright area with a semi-dark square, then you have a really dark area with a darker square, and it's bright again, right? And it's carpet on the floor. Okay, so you perceive it as that.
Right.
Now you add six lines, you draw a table on top of that area where it was darker. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, your brain reinterprets the dark area as a shadow.
As a shadow, right.
And you will swear on your life that the darker square is the same brightness as the one that are out in the light.
Right.
And six lines makes your brain totally reinterpret what you're looking at. Because our brain exists to undo lighting and try to look just at the albedo. For shapes, right? And that's why people can't intuit the Fresnel effect.
Right.
See how I tied it all back nicely?
That's
why people can't intuit it, because we do not see it. We see it in the extreme case, like on a black car, and you look at the...
Yeah.
Or if you take
your boss and you shove his face into the ground and make him see it.
Or yes, exactly. So you actually move, then you see it.
Yeah.
But on a round shape, you do not perceive that there's more reflectivity at the edges. On the classical teapot, only if it's like black do you see. For any other color, you just think the reflectivity is the same anywhere.
Right.
So if the person is given the knobs, mm-hmm. and he's given the knobs to set some reflectivity, he will just set something that is fixed across the whole thing.
Right.
And it will turn it up way too much, because it's actually, they say, 30% is probably good.
Right.
But no, it should be like 0.5%.
Or should be 100% reflective with a Fresnel.
With the Fresnel, exactly, right. Exactly. So this is why this mindset of I'll tweak it till it looks right, you can't.
No.
You simply can't. You're physiologically, provably physiologically incapable of tweaking it till it looks right.
Right. But let's go back to this, because there's something very important that I want to bring up. You're right. And using real physics is always good.
Yes.
As a starting point, because what it does is it helps you eliminate variables.
Yes.
Now, one of the things I do appreciate about PBR's approach is that it actually reduces variables, and that's actually its goal.
Yes.
To reduce the amount of maps that you require to do something.
Exactly.
And if you reduce the amount of maps you need, you can save a lot of memory, and that's why it's popular in games, right?
Yes.
I know. You're not. Tell me if you're going to be late for your meeting.
No, it's fine.
You're good. So. So that's a good thing. That's why it's very popular in the gaming industry. But it also turns out to be it's pretty simple to do things this way because it is less variables. Everyone is able to do it better.
Yep.
And it keeps moving forward. What became interesting to me as I started to think about how you introduced to me is like metalness as a state of, is not as a state as opposed to a variable.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
A chaos group, never really had a different state of things. They treated basically everything as dielectric.
Mm-hmm.
So to make a metal and you want to continue to use Fresnel, you basically made an IRR of like 20, which is...
That old trick, yes.
Right.
That might all be my fault, honestly.
Yeah.
Because I wrote some old tutorial 100 years ago before we even had the metal switch or something. Like, just turn up Fresnel to 25 or something.
Right.
And it kind of... doesn't really become metal at all, but
it looks
very
metallic.
Reflective.
Yes, it looks more metallic than turning off Fresnel. It looks better than turning off.
It does, yes.
Because it still has a curvature to it, to the reflectivity.
Yeah.
But if you actually now consider the fact that you can add metalness as a state and still use a Fresnel, then you actually can use real Fresnel values.
Yes.
Because there are Chromium has a Fresnel of like something like 3.8 or something like that.
Yeah, and that's there's something called complex IORs,
right,
which is complicated.
Right.
And people
that's
nerd.
That's why they're called complex.
No, they call complex because it's two dimensional. But anyway, that people nerd out over and try to find these magical numbers and all these kind of things. In practice, though, it simply turns out if you compute the complex Fresnel for various metals, it really just means that the edge color is a lot whiter than the facing color. And that's really all that's happened.
Yeah, but isn't there actually a Fresnel value? The second variable is wavelength, right?
It is.
So basically that's how you get gold. Gold reflectivity is because it actually reflects more of that color forward than it would any other color.
Yes. But still, I mean, complex IORs, you know, fine. But if you just give the user an edge color and a facing color, you kind of get the same result. It's way more intuitive than finding some document.
Okay, so what's your opinion about spectral rendering then at that point?
My opinion of spectral rendering is that someday it will more probably become useful, but that this is not that day.
It's not useful yet.
Like, well, it is. Okay.
But ultimately, we're still creating an RGB screen anyway, right?
Yeah, there's an RGB screen anyway. And there's a very interesting question about color management in relation to RGB rendering.
Okay.
Like, what RGB value, what's your primaries?
Okay.
Because when you compute in RGB, which we all do, it actually matters what the RGB primaries are, because think about it, if you have something that is 100% red, like red is 1 and green and blue is 0, if you let that, if this is reflective and reflects in itself like 5 times, the result will still be simply blue because, you know, that was 1 and the other 2 was 0. There will never be a component of something else.
Right.
But if it's blue in some color space, which you then convert to your rendering color space, and now it's suddenly 0.1, 0.72, and 0.001 or whatever, and you start multiplying these things with each other, you are actually changing the saturation of this color.
Right.
Which you didn't do before, but now you're doing it.
Right.
Because you're in a different color space. So in principle, if you want to be nerdy, doing any kind of math, especially multiplications on color, which is not multiplication with just a flat number, is all wrong in RGB, and there's no such thing as right. But as we know, we have rendered in RGB for years and years and years, right. And we get, you know, sufficiently fooled by most of it. Now, there are cases where spectral matter. Like, for instance, there, if you have a meat counter in a you know, a grocery store,
sure,
there's lights you can buy that has a particular peak in the particular red spectrum, which makes the meat look more delicious. Those are, by the way, I think illegal now, at least in Sweden. You can't use those lights in your grocery store, right, because it fools the viewer. But they exist, right? And if you were to try to render this in RGB, you can never get the right result. You can fake it by turning up the saturation on the meat. It's easier, right, but you can never like get that all correct. But it's such a special case. So, I mean, I have this argument with a lot of people. Some people.
Well, it's interesting because I know Dan Lemon over at Weta. He talks a lot about how you can never get skin looking right unless you use spectral rendering. Right?
There might be some truth to that. Yeah. There might be some truth to that, but I don't think spectral rendering is something we super must do.
But doesn't it actually reduce? Wouldn't it actually reduce the variables? Because instead of doing RGB, wouldn't you just need luminance and wavelengths?
Well, not really, because I mean that will be just one color. It will be monochromatic. So any actual color is a blend of every wavelength.
Right.
So you normally use like 30 bands.
Right.
It doesn't reduce. You multiply it by 10, the amount of data, basically.
Okay.
And the problem is really, let me put it this way. If you really were able to acquire everything, like lights are often known as spectra, so that's fine. Mm-hmm. But materials often are not. And which software would you use to paint your wood texture spectrally? I just wonder.
Yeah.
I mean, those things kind of doesn't exist.
Yeah. So the minute still paint in RGB. Yeah.
If you paint the texture, you're kind of screwed unless you do that all spectrally.
Right.
So as long as your texturing is RGB, it's kind of... And I think I read some paper a long time ago. It was good old Greg Ward, who kind of proven through some math that if you do just the first bounce spectrally, so the interaction, the direct lighting, the light and the surface, you compute that spectrally, turn it into RGB, and there's all the other light transport in RGB, the error could never be more than, or normally was not more than like 3% or something.
Wow.
I don't know how he computed it, and I might be misremembering, but in principle, it's like, it's the first interaction where it matters.
That's the one.
And it's kind of noise for everything else.
Right. Interesting.
So, but then your meat will have to be, you know, in that spectrum which has its peak, so it only shines red under that particular light that has that peak.
Interesting.
And I don't know any meat textures you can download which are spectral, but who knows? Maybe IKEA has them. They have scanners for everything.
They have scanners for everything.
And you guys have scanners
for
everything.
We have some scanners,
everything.
Too. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. All right. Well, listen, we're getting to be able to finish about one more subject here, and I want to talk about your opinion about... since you do know a lot about rendering and you've been doing this for a long time, some of the new stuff that's going on in terms of the real-time ray tracing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know if you... Did you see our Project Lavina stuff?
I saw some video that Vlado posted, yes.
Right,
That's a bunch of trees.
Yeah.
More than one tree.
300 billion polygons.
Exactly.
On one video card.
Slightly more than my video card could do.
Right. Well, I think what's interesting to me is, like, you know, I was talking about it. The demo is interesting. But what's most interesting to me is the enormous amount of data.
Yeah.
And what was fascinating to me is, Vlado says, we did it because this is something that a Scanlan renderer can't do. They can never fit that many polygons onto a system. And I remember that, like, scanline rendering has a limitation, but that's one that's I didn't know about. What is your thoughts about real-time ray tracing?
I don't quite understand why he would say that. Depends.
It wasn't just him. It was so we were discussing it in general. But
was this? Is this like multiply instanced stuff? I guess
there's a lot of instancing.
Because a ray tracer can cheat and only have instance geometry stored once.
Sure.
I guess that's what he means. And you can't do that with like a scanline based render. Mm-hmm. You kind of need everything there.
But you can also fit a lot more geometry in scanline than a ray tracer than you can in scanline.
This is the thing, you know, I was looking at the the Wreck-It Ralph talk here. It's funny with the talks for a movie that isn't even released yet, I think.
Right.
And it was interesting, but they were talking about how they were visualizing the internet and all the billions and gazillions and quadrillions of polygons that was in those scenes and how difficult it was to render. And the funny thing to me, I was looking at what I was seeing and everything was looking like insanely simple. I mean, you know, in Star Wars Episode 1 for the pod race, there's actually Q-tips. It's not an audience. It's painted Q-tips sitting in the bleachers, right? And I was like, some of this stuff probably have a few more polygons that you need, guys.
Right.
Couldn't, like, level of detail, maybe try that. And I once made a back of the envelope calculation for, if you imagine you make an HD frame, 1920 by 1080, and you imagine an anti-aliasing level of 64, you know, times in a pixel, so 64 rays in a pixel. I mean, you would never need actually more than 64 different at maximum for these rays to hit in that pixel.
Sure.
So what's the memory requirement of 64, you know, 64 triangles in each pixel? You can compute that. And it's not a terribly high value. It's like, you know, 20 gigabytes or something.
Yeah,
so in principle, any scene should never need to be bigger than 20 gigabytes.
Okay.
If it's properly optimized.
But that's to render just that.
Yes.
But what I'm talking about, real time.
Yeah, yeah.
So by doing real time, I can go anywhere.
Right,
and if
right,
I can go anywhere, then I need this. If the scene contains everything, I need to be able to contain everything.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm saying is, of course, half a joke, obviously.
No, but I understand what you're saying.
But it's like,
it's a valid point because a lot of people are still thinking of some people are still thinking of real-time rendering as a replacement for offline rendering. When really, when you do real-time rendering, it's a replacement. Real-time ray tracing is not a replacement for offline rendering. It's a replacement, or can become a replacement for real-time rendering.
Yes, for the classic rasterization and stuff like
that.
Yes, but I also think, I mean, I saw the NVIDIA presentation, and they were really saying a lot about real-time this and real-time that. And the real-time stuff looked okay because they were denoising it and all this kind of stuff. And I almost felt like they forgot the other side of it. Yes, you can make it real-time, or you can just render it a little longer than, you know, 1/60th of a second and actually get a really good image. So what they're really doing is just rendering really fast. I mean, he made it sound like this card was only awesome to, you know, do real-time rendering. It's not. It's awesome on your farm to do offline rendering.
Sure.
It would just be a lot faster.
Right.
And I felt that message kind of fell through the cracks because everything was so focused on real-time rendering. Yes, real-time rendering has to be, you know, 60 times or 24 times or 30 times per second. But if you just render a prettier picture and it takes 1 second, when it last week took 10 minutes, then you're also happy. A different kind of happy. It's not real-time, but it's damn fast.
I agree. But if you really do go to real time, if you go 24 frames a second or faster, let's just put it that way, then the way you interact with your scenes is different.
Yes.
Right? You know that if you're tweaking a shader and you have to wait a second for feedback, how much slower your progress will be compared to having to wait 24th of a second. Right?
Yeah.
So real-time
even though in the tweaking a shader case, I mean, you probably only need a few frames per second, but you don't want it to take multiple seconds.
You want to be able to move that dial and see that difference happening while you're moving the dial and lift your finger off the dial when you have it right.
Yeah.
You know? And that was not possible.
No.
And it may be starting to be possible.
Yeah. Although, you know, software rendering has become pretty fast too these days, and so I think the key here is the interactivity of it, regardless if it's a GPU or whatever, the fact that we today can render fast enough to do like anything in real time or semi-real time to get something nice and to interactively play with it is way nicer. I saw some old DVD extra from like 15 years ago. I think it was for the first Shrek or something. And they were doing a test render of some material and did this little small selection of a little corner of the dragon. You can see it like painting the scan lines.
Yeah.
Was this material better than the last one? And I think they had some tool flipping back and forth. And it's like these days you just, let's just say you turn the knob and you see it changing and you lift your finger, maybe in the whole image, you know, you lift your finger when you're done. And it's so much nicer to work that way.
Yeah,
the real-time stuff, of course, helps. But again, my point is that probably doesn't have to be that real-time to be good enough. Okay. I mean, maybe 10 frames a second is good enough, way good enough to tweak a shader.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, I think it's a fascinating field. I am very excited about what is going on. What I find interesting is I think that there's been a bit of a mixed reaction from people. We've been working on this for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So to me, I'm just like excited that we're finally able to talk about it live. But because we've been working on it for a long time, I've been thinking about it for a long time. Mm-hmm. So suddenly introducing it to people and they say, I don't understand. They seem like it's kind of like they don't understand what's happening. But I think that 2018 will be remembered as the year where real-time ray tracing started to happen.
That might be the case, yes.
You know, and when real-time ray tracing started happening, then 2 years from now, they're like, going to talk about it like that moment, right?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think when the iPhone came out in 2007, it was like, this is the year the iPhone came out. Well, a little bit. But the 2007, literally, there were plenty of smartphones before that, but 2007, the iPhone came out, and suddenly it was a different kind of market.
Yeah.
And they redefined everything. And I'm not never owned an iPhone.
It's like,
but I think still
I have an example which kind of relates to this. As you know, I was the person who was crazy enough to put OSL into 3ds Max.
Yeah.
And
you
want the OSL shaders to, you know, ideally show up in the viewport,
right,
in the like the OpenGL world.
Yeah.
So we're doing, you know, a bunch of work for that. But these days it's also so easy to just turn on like rendering in the viewport. So I'm feeling we're getting to the point, we're still doing a bunch of this work to make it happen, but I'm looking at it and say, do we actually need, can we just, isn't it good enough to just use the render if you want to like really see what you're doing?
Right.
Should we spend all this energy to make the thing so all that really shows up in the live viewport? When if that's what you want, you could just hit render, because the rendering, especially with the new GPUs and stuff, you know,
why not just render it?
Exactly. So, but I mean, people might want to do like play blast animation with the textures looking as good as possible, and then.
Right.
Then maybe after yesterday, basically, maybe that will be fast enough. But in the normal cases, rendering is fast, but it's not so fast that you just hit play on an animation right now.
Yeah.
So,
We'll see. We'll see. Anyway, this has been fascinating, Zap. I really appreciate you coming by. This is good that we were able to do this. I think it'd be fun.
We have to do part two, because we only got halfway through the history there.
Oh, so. I know. Yeah. I know. We still have a lot more history to go through. But I wanted to make sure we talked about some of that stuff that's current as well, because I thought that it was a very good conversation, and it's relevant towards things that are happening. And I think there's definitely more to talk about, so I'm sure we'll run into each other and we'll continue with
part two.
Do a part two.
That's also acquisitions involved there, but it's a different story. We get there. We got to the mental part. The funny thing, like I said jokingly, but there's two sayings I use.
Uh-huh.
One is the, I'm not a mathematician, I'm a magician, because I actually don't do math very well. If I need an equation solved, I ask Wolfram Alpha what the equation solving is.
Right.
I have some mathematical training, but if people show me Greek squiggles and stuff, that's like, I don't get that. Show me the source code.
Sure.
And when they rewrite it as a piece of code, they're squiggly dead spiders with Greek in, and like, oh, that's what you meant. Of course, that's obvious. You know. And I also have this like intuitive sense for like vector math and all these kind of things, which is actually easy. I was thinking of making a course for writing shaders, since it's now so simple to do it in OSL in Max.
Right.
So I have this idea of making like an OSL writing for dummies, and specifically the chapter about vector math is something I really wanted to like teach about, because vector math is a thing that sounds super complicated,
right?
But the vector math you actually use and is useful is so stupidly simple that it's ridiculous,
right?
And most people don't understand how trivially simple it is.
Right.
Like, you know, what's the cosine of the angle between two vectors? You just take the dot product.
Okay.
And like, how does that even work? It's magic. I don't know how it works.
Right.
I'm not a mathematician. I'm a magician, but I just know that it works. And whatever. Assuming they're unit vectors and whatever.
Sure.
The other saying is, of course, this: nothing I do professionally have any training for whatsoever, which is kind of true.
Right.
So beware running any software I've written. They tend to kind of work, but nobody ever taught me that.
All right.
So that's
good. That's fun, Zap. Well, thank you so much, and we will follow up with a second part.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you.